Welcome to Horangi Cybersecurity's Ask a CISO podcast. Come with us as we take a deep dive behind the scenes with the world's top cybersecurity leaders to get insights into security issues you care about. Before we take off, please help us grow by taking just a few seconds to like and subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, and leave us a review letting us know what you think of the podcast and how we can improve.
Adam is also an affiliate professor at the University of Washington. While at Microsoft, Adam drove the auto-run fix into Windows Update. He was the lead designer of the SDL threat modeling tool V3 and created the Elevation of Privilege game. Shostak is the author of Threat Modeling, Designing for Security, the co-author of the New School of Information Security, and his latest book, Threats, What Every Engineer Should Learn from Star Wars, was published in January of this year. Adam, it is awesome to have you on today's podcast episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, great to be here with you.
Awesome. So I wanted to start today with probably the thing that, you know, a lot of people would know you for, and that is threat modeling. It's a topic that's come up a lot in some of our recent episodes. And I guess I just wanted to kind of start the episode by setting the context. What does threat modeling really mean to you?
So threat modeling is the measure twice, cut once of security. It's getting a little bit away from the weeds to what's the context of what we're doing? How should we be thinking about it? There are so many details that we have to pay attention to, but the threats are enduring. They're things that come up over and over again. And I think one analogy that I've been using lately is that if we think about the threats, they're a little bit like genres of music, right? We've got rock and roll, we've got jazz. Those don't change very much, but there's a new song every day. And so threat modeling is learning to recognize the genres. It's learning to deal, breaking the metaphor a little bit, it's learning to deal with the genres. How do we address spoofing in this system? How do we address information disclosure in this system? And then it helps us engineer better systems, because instead of being focused on, oh, that's a really nice guitar riff in this song, or that's a really cool way of exploiting memory corruption in this exploit, we can say, oh yeah, it's Friday. There's another bunch of CVEs out today. There's another bunch of problems out today. But because we've threat modeled, we're dealing with all of those in a systematic and structured way. And so to me, that's the essence of threat modeling, is using models to help us think about what can go wrong and what we're going to do about it, rather than getting caught up in every single detail.
Yeah. So to kind of use that analogy to make sure I'm kind of hearing you right, if I think about, you know, let's say API security, the domain space where I spend a lot of my time, if I think about, you know, we've got identity as kind of a high level genre, and then we've got this new wave of things that is happening around like broken object level or function level authorization. Authorization kind of is maybe like the novel type of attack or logical exploit that's happening within this larger genre of identity relative to APIs. Is that kind of the right way to think about it?
Yeah. And I would, I love the two things you brought up. Identity is a way of thinking about authentication. It's a way of thinking about the threat of spoofing, right? Spoofing and identity are sides of the coin. And similarly, the authorization issues are issues with what we think of as expansion of authority, or more traditionally, elevation of privilege, are the flip side of authorization issues. And so if we use those threats to structure our thinking, we could say, or we could ask, you know, are we in API security dealing with these threats in a comprehensive way? And it gives us a chance to say, what might the next thing be?
Mm. Got it. So if we're thinking about, you know, let's say that kind of continuing on that path of authentication and authorization, and we think specifically about authorization, we can think about like, okay, escalation of privileges is one of the current things we know about, but what would be some of the, let's say, some of the consequences of escalation of privilege in terms of, let's say, functionality or data accessed once that privilege has been escalated? And so what are kind of the risks of, let's say, data exposure or application abuse, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we can also think of that. And what you said is actually really interestingly subtle. And okay. I think about the mechanism and the impact. And I like to focus in on the mechanism part. Because once somebody has violated one layer of security, there's often this explosion of things that can happen. But we can also think about this information disclosure issue at a fundamental level, right? Is our API exposing information to the clients that it shouldn't be, right? Do we have good encapsulation? Right. Do we have good protection for that? Do we have, were our APIs designed with integrity in mind, right? And today, modern designs tend to have some sort of message authentication code or signature built into them. Earlier APIs often didn't, and so there were all sorts of, oops, forgot to check whether or not we've got the right number of arguments sorts of problems in those earlier designs. And so to me, using some sort of system to help us think of broadly about what's going to happen to our design helps us anticipate and address those issues, those threats.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's funny, not to go too far down the API tangent, but ironically, we've kind of come to the place where we've started to get better, and I think we're actually moving away from that a little bit with the rise of things like GraphQL that start to actually allow broader API queries now, and they move away from kind of constraining to a fixed number of, let's say, request parameters or types of data that can be queried. But, you know, I just want to kind of like keep on the threat modeling track for a second. One of the things that I've observed in my time working in cybersecurity, you know, I spent about 13 years as a practitioner implementing systems. We tended very often to kind of focus on a layer of security that we think is very important. Let's say something like network perimeter security, or let's say something like, you know, antivirus, anti-malware on the operating system level or so on. What kind of led you to start thinking about threat modeling? Because I think of threat modeling from everything that you've said and some of our previous guests, Izar and Matthew, who recently wrote a book as well, were on recently, and they talked about threat modeling as kind of examining the design of an application both on its own and in the context of where it's going to be running as the starting point for doing threat modeling. And I tend to see a lot of cybersecurity practitioners focus on individual points of attack and not so much on system design. So I'm curious, like, how did you start thinking about threat modeling? What really led you down that path?
It's a hard question because I want to say I've always been a systems thinker, and I probably haven't been. But I think that a lot of when I started in what we now call cybersecurity, it wasn't yet a field that had a lot of defined product categories. I predate the CISSP. Yeah. I predate most degree programs. And so I had to take this information that was coming at me and organize it in some way. And so to me, thinking about what is the right organization for this problem is something that I've always had to do some of. And today we are given categories like identity and access management or DLP or whatever category you want to say, API security. And we start to think that those categories are natural in some way, but they're all constructs that people have created. And so for me, I've always asked why this category. And my time at Microsoft was where I really switched from thinking about this as something I do to something that we have to be able to explain to other people. We have to be able to systematize what we do. We have to be able to teach it. Because when you go, and Izar and Matt had the same experiences in their jobs, when you go from I do this to we do this to you or y'all do this, it changes the way we do it, because we have to be able to say, Jeremy, you and I are going to do this the same way, so that we can meet some policy that the corporation, our employer, our industry association has. And that requires us to really say, what are we doing here?
Yeah. But this brings up a really good point, and I kind of have two follow-up questions around it. So Izar and Matt very specifically targeted a lot of their threat modeling work and activities towards developers, because I know they were very concerned with kind of secure software development, to simplify it, right? I know that is an oversimplification, but, you know, building more secure applications, let's say. When you think in that kind of system context, two questions come to mind for me. One is, who are the most important stakeholders? If you're starting a threat modeling exercise today, who are some of the most important stakeholders that you engage with within an organization? And two, how frequently should we be revisiting threat models that we come up with? And then actually a bonus third kind of follow-up question, like, do you think there's a role, are tabletop exercises one of the things that you tend to do when you do threat modeling? Because I know for a lot of activities that we look at, let's say like anti-ransomware, we just went through one internally and a couple others. And I found them to be pretty useful in terms of thinking through both like recoveries and responses, but also in terms of, let's say, proactive steps that we can take to help keep the organization safer. So what role do you see for tabletop exercise? And I'll stop talking because I've asked you a lot. So go ahead.
So let me start with the first one. Who should be involved? It's really tempting to quote Steve Ballmer and say developers, 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 developers. But developers, project managers, product owners, usability people, accessibility people, executives, everyone can threat model, and everyone should. When we threat model, one of the fundamental questions we ask is what can go wrong? And there are some variants of this, like what are you worried about? And if we ask that question with an open mind and open ears, we learn so much. We give people the chance to engage with what they're doing. And this naming of a ritual has a lot of power. When we talk about backlog grooming or retrospectives, and we give them names, we make time in the schedule for them. And if we make time in the schedule to ask what can go wrong, that's really valuable. And if we engage with a diverse community of stakeholders, people will bring their own experience and say, I'm worried about this use of the system. And the more people we have in that conversation, the less likely we are to have the oh crap moment where we didn't think of something. Now the system is poured in concrete. We can't change it as easily. Now we've got a crisis. Mm-hmm. You asked a you asked a question about tabletops and how often, So,
yep.
You know, it's the Azar and Matt fan show. Azar Tarandok, and we should just mention, by the way, I'm looking over Threat Modeling, A Practical Guide for Developers by Azar Tarandok and Matt Coles. Great book. And Azar likes to say, threat model every story. And it's a powerful, powerful way to think about what we're doing. And if we think about threat modeling as an activity we do more than a deliverable we produce, just asking what can go wrong with this story, why would we not do that? Some people put questionnaires in place, 10, 20, 50 questions to try and help people think through that. It gets really tedious, frankly. It becomes a checkbox exercise rather than asking people to spend a minute thinking. And tabletops, I think tabletops are a form of threat modeling, right? We're abstracting what can go wrong from, you know, I saw a ChatGPT generated list of threat actor names this morning, so I'm going to go with Platinum Shark. Platinum Shark could ransomware us. We don't need to know the details of who the threat group is or how precisely they negotiate. We can use a tabletop as a way of operationally threat modeling and pulling in those people, the executives, the incident response people, and using the model of the threat to say, what are we going to do when this happens? What questions would we like to have asked? For example, maybe we should have had better network segmentation might come out of a tabletop exercise. And so, tabletops are great threat models. And we can do it earlier. We can do it before we build the thing that we're going to be using in the tabletop so that the tabletop and real incidents run more smoothly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great point. I want to ask a question that comes up a lot when we think about cybersecurity anywhere. And that is that, you know, there's this view that every organization will probably get breached at some point if you haven't been already. You know, you may be breached right now and you don't know it. We hear a lot of these kinds of, let's say, sort of negative statements around it. And I think there's some value in kind of presenting these things to get people's attention and to get them to pay more attention to security, generally speaking. I'm curious, as you go through threat modeling, there's got to be some kind of interaction or at least some kind of tension or trade-off with kind of overall risk management. Because I imagine that as part of some threat modeling exercises, you come to a conclusion at some point where it's like, okay, yes, we could eliminate 100% of the threats that we know about with our designs and with mitigating factors. But then there's like, is there value or are we facing diminishing business value by trying to address some of these things? How do you think about that trade-off, or how do you recommend organizations think about that trade-off?
So the way I think about this, first, let me introduce threat modeling for people who might not be familiar with it. At the core of threat modeling, we ask four very simple questions. What are we working on? What can go wrong? What are we going to do about it? And did we do a good job? And oftentimes, as we think about the question of what are we going to do about it, the answer is relatively simple. Fix your S3 buckets, please. Other times, the answer is much more complicated. You know, for example, if we have a banking app, we could eliminate a whole bunch of risks by not letting you move money in the app. And the app is a lot less useful. And so we have a situation where we can't eliminate the risk. We can put in preventative controls. We can put in detective controls. And there's a residual risk. And to me, when we go from threat modeling to trying to quantify the risk, the probability that it might happen, the impact if it does. That's when threat modeling feeds into more traditional risk management. Excuse me.
Yeah. And interesting.
We can engage in accept, transfer, eliminate sorts of things for those things where there's no clean technical fix that really fixes the problem.
Okay. And when you work on that, that quantification, that's going to be pretty much different for every scenario, right? And that's got to be, that kind of transfers from being a security decision to really being a business decision at some point, right?
Yeah, and you know, when we do sort of the traditional risk management work, there's fire, there's flood, there's tornado, there's theft, there's things that we know about because they happen over and over again in the physical world. And so we don't need to go through a big complex process or a potentially complex process of figuring out what can go wrong, because our history, our background, our intuition fills that in. In technology, because we're doing new things, the ways in which things go wrong can also be new and different. And so we need a little bit more effort to make sure we know what can go wrong. And as I talk about this, it's easy to fall into talking about threat modeling as big and complex. It doesn't need to be. It can be as simple as asking, what can go wrong? And people will point out all sorts of things if we make a little bit of time for it.
Yeah, yeah. And probably there's also got to be some truth. You know, we talked about stakeholders earlier on. I imagine there's also a lot of truth. And if you bring a diverse set of stakeholders, let's say coming from InfoSec, from the application development team, from the architecture team, maybe from the identity team, all of those people are going to bring different perspectives and probably different ideas about potential threats and risks to the table, and you're going to get a more complete view with kind of a more robust and a more complete audience, right?
Yes. And you know, it's I don't mean to criticize here, but I want to point out that everyone you listed in your diverse group is a technological professional building software deploying software.
Yep.
And I want to push more broadly. Let's bring in the marketing team. Let's bring in the salespeople. Let's bring in executives. Let's bring in all of the brains that we have in the organization, right? Maybe sales will say, you know, all of this customer identity proofing that you want to do, we're going to lose 30% of people because they just don't want to fill out these forms. Do we really need to do this?
Yeah.
And lose 30% of people is part of what can go wrong, because what we're doing is not well thought through. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great point. I have a friend here locally who's a CISO at a large organization, and I won't use his name because I didn't give me permission to use this quote, but he brought up this point that, you know, you can kind of go through these steps of security, and eventually you get to the point where the most secure computer is the one that is encased in concrete and at the bottom of the ocean floor and completely air-gapped and disconnected, and so it's complete, you know, it's useless at that point, so you can reach that point. So it's a great, valid point. And I appreciate you, you know, kind of raising that issue of expanding the tent, so to speak, and bringing in those additional stakeholders. I want to take a second to change topics, and I want to explore vulnerability management, because I know you worked on the CVE, and that's been something that has been around for, I don't know, maybe decades at this point. It is, if not, at least one decade. And it's something I spent some time working for one of the big vendors in the vulnerability management space. And I personally have an opinion that vulnerability management is a very important function, but I don't think organizations are generally approaching it correctly in the modern technology landscape. For instance, my view is that, you know, the risks of automated patching are very low right now. You know, we're not facing the same kind of situation that we faced, let's say, in the late 90s or the early 2000s, where, you know, an updated Windows DLL would break multiple applications that we needed to run our business. First of all, so many things were running through SaaS or web-based applications anyway. So let's say operating system patches and browser patches are pretty low risk at this point. What's your view on how organizations should think about vulnerability management in 2023 and kind of moving forward?
So in the cloud world, you know, as we really adopt cloud patterns like serverless, the need for CI/CD pipelines and automated patch, the need for CI/CD pipelines makes automated patching something that we can do. And we've got systems that help us manage whatever risk might be there in terms of slow rollouts, rollbacks, etc. And I think that you're 100% right there. When I talk to customers about things like their legacy data centers, their IoT fleets, their distributed workforces having Windows machines, those, I worry differently about automated patching. And I think, having worked at Microsoft for a long time, that by and large, automated patching of Windows makes sense. Automatically updating your browser makes sense. But I don't want to dismiss the concern that if you have 10,000 employees scattered around the United States and you brick their laptops on Tuesday morning, that's going to be a painful recovery process. And
yeah,
for all the energy Microsoft does put into making that low risk, I think they could still do more. I think we've still seen in recent memory bad problems with it. What should they do is a somewhat complicated question. But as long as people have this concern, and this concern is grounded in facts, it's so important to manage patchability, to manage the process of patching. You know, I do a lot of work with medical device companies, and the FDA for the last 8 or 9 years has saying, everything's got to be auto-updatable. You've got to make sure that updates are available through the lifetime of your device. And there is a lot of complexity in automatically patching medical devices in a hospital, for example. But in the cloud scenario, which more and more of us are moving to for incredibly good reasons of focusing our energy on what matters to the business, automated patching is a huge win.
Yeah. The thing that concerns me, and I totally get that example you raised of medical devices, and I know that's just one example out of probably many, many use cases where there are still legitimate concerns, so I totally get that. The thing that has always concerned me the most is that still the statistics around the time from discovery of a vulnerability to the time of patching of that vulnerability is over 6 months, and it's been that for like a decade. And I just worry that, you know, we're not getting better as an industry at kind of making it easier or making it more streamlined, et cetera. And still organizations are spending a lot of time on patching where they really, you know, should be doing other things to make their environments more secure.
You know, the energy that we spend on an activity that we label risk management, but is really just arguing about patches, is extreme. And if we put that energy into building better update, rollout, rollback, automated testing, we would get so much further. And I think we agree on that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left here, Adam, and I wanted to kind of close today's conversation with a couple things. I know you are honestly kind of a prolific author at this point, at least 3 books that I know of, and there's maybe some that I'm missing. And I kind of wanted to ask the question, we've had a few authors on the podcast, and we've got a lot of listeners who are actually experts in various areas. What's some of the advice you would give to people who are thinking about writing something, you know, as an aspiring author, potentially? Like, what should they focus on if they're thinking about writing a book or an ebook in an area where they are kind of a domain expert?
There is no try. There is do or do not. Give it a shot. Writing is hard. Ask some friends for honest feedback. No one is a good writer when they start. There's a lot of practice. There's a lot of listening carefully to criticism and saying, how can I write this better? How can I write this more clearly? And give it a try, but also recognize that, and I've actually written 4 books and published 3, because one of them stank and I put it on the shelf and let it go.
And did you come to that conclusion on your own, or was that feedback from, let's say, like early beta testers, if you will?
Yeah, that was me reading it and being like, this is not coming together well as a book. I don't enjoy reading it, and I'll be honest with you, I enjoy reading my Star Wars book, and maybe that's just me enjoying my own work, but I think I did a pretty good job writing it, and the feedback I've been getting is people have been enjoying it. So if you don't enjoy your own work, who will?
Yeah, that's a great point. But let's talk about that book for a second. I mean, first, kind of, aside from being a fan, and who isn't a fan of Star Wars, was there any particular reason that you kind of chose that universe to draw examples from?
So I started in this a little bit by accident and said, I'm going to use Star Wars to explain the principles of Salter and Schroeder. It's a classic paper in cybersecurity. And what I realized as I did it is the technology is really fundamental to Star Wars. Star Wars itself, you know, A New Hope, Episode 4, is the story of a stolen data tape. It's a data breach. And everything in the movie is about that stolen data tape. There's clear, easy ties to things like Kirchhoff's principle about no security by obscurity. In the rebels find the problem with the Death Star in like 5 minutes, right? It's obvious once the plans are analyzed what the problem is. And when I compare this to other universes, everyone wants to talk about Trek. Let's talk about Star Trek, which is wonderful. I love a lot of things about Star Trek. But there's a famous quote from one of the writers who said, we would just write tech, tech, tech in the scripts, and someone would fill in the babble later. Because Trek is so grounded in the humanity of its characters and the stories it's telling about society, the tech doesn't matter in the way it does in Star Wars. And that makes Star Wars a great universe on which to build, you know, the subtitle of the book is What Every Engineer Should Learn from Star Wars. And there's so many stories in that universe, and even in the first, in the main 3 movies, which is another value, right? Trek, it's a expansive world. So is Star Wars at this point. So is the Marvel Universe. But not everyone has seen everything in it. Many, many people have seen the core 3 Star Wars movies, which is why I use them in the book.
Yeah. There's got to also be two other aspects that I wonder about. And I mean, certainly to your point about you've got to make it enjoyable to read. You know, I think about things like security awareness training and so on. And I was recently talking to somebody whose security awareness training was done as like a set of Viking episodes. And they continually brought that up to me when they were talking about it. And what struck me is their security awareness training was actually memorable and, you know, and enjoyable. And that's why it stuck. The security training that I've done at a few corporations is like stock photos. It is so bland that I don't think I could tell you anything from that security awareness training anymore. So I've got to imagine that that also kind of, you know, was an extra bonus for you as you thought about writing it. And then the other thing that comes to mind is like from a threat modeling perspective, that Death Star design of having one single point of failure externally exposed, you know, there's got to be a great analogy to like a modern cloud application where, you know, you could take down an entire app with one single point of interaction, you know, like the wrong, let's say like the wrong request payload against one API and boom, the whole app goes down. Like that's a terrible system design that any good threat modeling exercise should have uncovered, right?
So, you know, the specific flaw of here's this port, there's a really funny little short titled The Death Star Architect Speaks Out. It's 3 minutes, and the Death Star architect says, how could a missile fly down a miles-long tube? How does that even work? Nobody told me I had to worry about that. And the thing that's so evocative about Star Wars is we can absolutely say what you just said, or we can flip it on its head, and we can say, to exploit that flaw, we need a kill chain of steal the plans, which is its whole other kill chain, get the plans to the rebel base, analyze them, be lucky to discover that we've got X-Wing fighters on hand. The Death Star shows up instead of a bunch of Star Destroyers. And so we can also use Star Wars to think about the chain, or the kill chain, as it were.
Such a great point.
And Star Wars, the world building, and I have to compliment everyone who's worked on this, the world building that Star Wars does is so strong that you can pull these things out of it and have a lot of fun.
Yep.
And that's my hope for the book, is that, as you said, it's engaging. And then all of a sudden you notice you're learning stuff as you go. And I hope that bringing those two together really makes the readers powerful, makes them smarter, makes them more able to secure their systems.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I think that's a great note to end today's conversation on. Again, the guest has been Adam Shostak. Adam's latest book, Threats, What Every Engineer Should Learn from Star Wars, is available now. Any particular place you would want our audience to buy it from?
The book is for the readers. Buy it where you want to. And let me mention that my local technical bookstore, Ada's Books in Seattle, has signed copies available if you'd like one of those. But really, it's available where fine books are sold.
Awesome, awesome. Well, if you can get to Ada's Books, that's a special treat for that assigned edition. Otherwise, the book is Threats, What Every Engineer Should Learn from Star Wars. Our guest today has been Adam Shostak. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Ask a CISO today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.